Welcome to Steppin' Out of Babylon, produced by Sue Supriano. Babylon is everywhere. It's the isms and schisms not only within the system, but within ourselves. Let's unify, stand aligned, and step out of Babylon.
Hi, everybody. My name's Sue Supriano, and I'm happy today to be meeting Ram Rahat and Ishai Shagi. They are both from Israel, although Ram is originally from Canada. He's lived in Israel for a very long time, and they are resistors in the military, which is a brave thing to do. And they're here in the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area, brought here by a Jewish Voice for Peace. And we're going to hear their stories. And the most wonderful thing in the world would be if all the military folks in the world stood up like you and said, we won't do it. So who wants to start with a little bit of background? Ishai.
Well, I do think that it would be a most wonderful thing, but until the day that happens, you'll have to remember that one country has a right to defend itself, and that's essentially what is going on in the Middle East right now. All kinds of countries, all kinds of people defending themselves. My story begins in 1995 when I was recruited to the Israeli army. In Israel, everyone has to report to enlist to the Israeli army at 18 for 3 years at the minimum. And I was recruited. I asked to be in the artillery. I got what I asked for. And, well, after 4 years, 4 months of basic training, I was sent to the territories, the occupied territories, to the city of Tul Karem, and we started out what used to be regular day-to-day work in Tul Karem, in the Palestinian cities. That was before Israel pulled out of the A areas of the Palestinians areas, and we were sitting inside Tul Karem itself. On those days, the days of the late Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin, we all thought that peace was at reach. We were about to have peace, and whatever we did was under the impression that in a few months or so it will all be over. What we did was basically roadblocks. Testing Palestinians going to work in Israel, making sure that they are not carrying bombs, and making sure that they have work permits. No one without a work permit will be allowed to cross to Israel. We also secured bases, military bases inside Tul Karem, and secured settlements around Tul Karem, Israeli settlements. I also had.
When you say secured, maybe you want to say just a little bit more about this, because this is an opportunity to take these words, which are used all the time on the media, and make them kind of concrete, since you were doing it.
Okay, sure. A secured settlement means that you guard the settlement. You put your soldiers in patrol around the settlements. And you just guard them the same as you guard a building, a single building, or a country. And you put a border around the settlement, and no one is allowed to cross it except through the gate. And at the gate, there are gate guards, and they check everyone who gets in. You also have to secure the road to the settlement because that's where most bombings and most terrorist acts take place, on the road. They shoot from the surrounding hills, the surrounding forests, or they just throw stones, which can be very, very dangerous for a car, because when a stone hits the windshields powerful enough, it can hurt the driver, and the driver derails, I don't know how to say it in English, goes off the road, crashes, and may kill everyone inside the car. So you have to secure the roads, which is done mainly by patrolling the roads themselves and the sides of the roads. And you secure the settlement itself by guarding its perimeter. I had also the chance to participate in an Israeli Security Agency action, where we went into, at the middle of the night, we went into a Palestinian, very hostile village. And we started searching door to door. We started searching for propaganda and weapons. We just busted in. We knocked on the door loudly to wake them up. Shouted "Iftach el Bab Jish," open the door. It's the army. And we went in. I was covering the security agency guys who searched all over the house, tore out mattresses, pulled out cupboards, and searched for weapons, concealed weapons. While the family, which I had to secure so they wouldn't run out or start attacking us, sat in the living room, about 10 people, sat in the living room, cold, scared, just awakened in the middle of the night, looking at us. Finally, the soldiers, the security agency guys, usually found a leaflet and they waved in their hands, saying Palestinian propaganda, and then they shouted at the head of the house some more, and then we left. Also, I got to secure a base in the center of Tulkarem, the civilian administrative base. Civilian administrative is the name the army gave to its bases, where the Palestinians had to go to get work permits and driving licenses. What we in Israel, when we want those things, we go to the Ministry of Interior offices. They have to go to army offices called the civilian administrative. And I was guarding that base until one day I heard shouting behind me. Turned around, I saw a Palestinian who came there to get his work permit and an Israeli officer. The Israeli officer told him to get out because no one talks in his line. The Palestinian promised him, "I won't talk in the line again." The Israeli officer kept shouting at him and at some point took his M16 and pointed it at the man's forehead and told him to get out. The Palestinian grabbed hold of the barrel of the rifle, and pushed it away from him and said, I'm sorry, I need this work, please, I won't talk again. And the Israeli officer pushed it again against the guy's head and loaded the weapon, which was a very terrifying thing for me, a young soldier, to see. I was sure it was going to shoot him in the head. And then two border policemen came and took the Palestinian out, beating him, just because he was talking in the line. Again, all the things we did then, and all the things I'm going to tell you about that I did later, were military justified. They all had a logic. They all were. We had to do them because we were there, and that's exactly the problem, as we will see afterwards. After 4 months in the territories, I was also in Hebron guarding the settlement inside Hebron. So I saw settler kids throwing stones at Palestinian cars in the parking lots, breaking the windows and trying to set fire to them. Mm-hmm. And after 4 months of this, I returned to the training camp, got my sergeant stripes in the sergeant course, and went on to officer's course and got my first lieutenant rank. As a first lieutenant, I didn't get back to the territories. At first I was sent back to sergeant course to be a teacher in sergeant course, and I taught a lot. About 100 soldiers went under my hands, and I taught them how to be sergeants, and I gave them their stripes. Afterwards, I went to an active battalion, and we were in the Golan Heights, guarding Israel from Syria. Then we went down to Lebanon, and I went on a few tours into Lebanon with my soldiers. And then I was called back into just as my battalion was supposed to go into the territories, I was called back to the sergeant course for higher. I was then not a first lieutenant, but a full lieutenant. I was supposed to do more. I taught more people how to be good sergeants, at least good as I see it. And then I was released from the conscript army. That was in 1995, and 4 years after I was enlisted. And I joined the reserve forces. Everyone in Israel has to do a reserve duty 1 month a year. The first year, 1999, I trained with my new unit. And the next year, we got called up on an emergency call to the territories. That was immediately after the Al-Aqsa riots, Al-Aqsa Intifada. And we were called to just below Nablus, just south of Nablus. When we were called, I came there, and we all sat, me and my soldiers, we all sat in a big auditorium, and the commander of the area showed us the maps, showed us the what we were supposed to do, and gave us the directions. Anyone who picks a stone, picks up a stone. Any Palestinian who picks up a stone, shoot him. No matter the age, no matter the sex, shoot him. This, again, is very, very logical, because, as I explained earlier, a stone thrown at the car is very, very dangerous to the car, and the topographic nature of the area we were in was very, very dangerous, because even a six-year-old boy could go up to the road, and the roads over there are surrounded by cliffs, very high cliffs, and he can just pick up a stone, put it over the cliff, and leave it. He doesn't have to throw it. It will go through the windshield like butter. And that's very, very dangerous. And to protect the lives of the Israelis driving on that road, you had to make sure that no one throws a stone over the cliffs, even if it is a six-year-old boy. And again, we were guarding settlements, and we were guarding the roads to the settlements. And every order that was given there was perfectly logical and perfectly necessary to protect the lives of those people living there. But then I realized that that's all we were doing. I wasn't defending Israel. I wasn't defending my parents. I wasn't defending my sister, my brothers, my grandparents. I was defending only those people living there and making Israel life tougher. And then I again realized that if I could take all my soldiers, pull them back, and put them around the territories, I will be able to make sure that no bomber, no terrorist will cross into Israel proper. But because I was forced to guard those settlers who were scattered around the territories, I wasted my soldiers' time. I wasted our time and potentially our lives guarding people who shouldn't be there, as I see it, and exposing Israel to greater danger. I took the point even further, and I realized that it is also degrading to the deteriorating the Israeli society. I noticed how the violence rose inside Israel, how soldiers, 18-year-old kids, went to the territories, got orders to shoot Palestinians, While the settlers who threw stones, we were not allowed to touch them. And where I was, every other Friday, the settlers went down to the junction, threw stones at Palestinian cars. Settlers at one point even burned one car. And the Israeli army has orders not to touch them, but to secure them, to guard them. God forbid if a Palestinian throws a stone back, shoot him. So the only ones who can deal with the settlers are the Israeli police, 15 minutes away. So we had to call the police and wait 15 minutes while the settlers are throwing stones and endangering Palestinian life. And we weren't allowed to touch them, but if a Palestinian raises a stone, shoot him. And a soldier, an 18-year-old soldier who gets this kind of order, and he looks up to his officers, so every order he gets from his officers is like a commandment from God, this kind of soldier returns home with those values instilled in him. He realizes that there are two kinds of people in the world. There are the light skins who speak Hebrew, and you are not allowed to touch them. They are human beings and they have rights. And there are the dark skins who speak Arabic who don't have rights. So even left-wing people who served in the army have those values instilled within them, and they don't realize that. They may vote for left-wing parties, but they don't behave like it. They don't really think like it. And every Israeli I know, and that includes me, doesn't trust the Palestinians. And on the other hand, you see what we are doing to the Palestinians. The Palestinian kids who saw me burst into their house in 1995. And shouted at their father and pointed a gun at their mother, is now growing up to be a terrorist. And my deepest fear is hearing that the same kid that I went into his house at 95 yesterday exploded in Tel Aviv or something like that. I can't live with the knowledge that I'm creating tomorrow's terrorists. I think that the moment when the Palestinian kids don't see Israeli army near their houses would be the perfect moment. You have to understand that the infrastructure of terror that Sharon is talking about is not the M16s, it's not the explosion belts, it's not the knives, it's the Palestinian kid. The Palestinian kid is the infrastructure of terror. The Palestinian kid's heart is the Palestinian infrastructure of terror. And you cannot solve that without pulling out of the territories. While we are in the territories, we are compromising Israel's security, and I will not do that again. That's what I told my commanders. That's what I told them again after 7 months when I was called again to serve in the territories. I told them I will not do it. This is compromising Israel's security. I requested to serve in the Golan Heights, in Lebanon, in the borders with Egypt or Jordan. And when they refused and gave me a direct order to go to the territories, I told them I will not do that. I was sentenced to 26 days in prison. After that, I joined Yesh Gvul, which is a movement supporting people like me who refused to go beyond the 67 borders and refused to help the occupation. And that's it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I want to remind the audience that you've just heard Ishai Shagi, who is one of two Israeli peace activists who I'm sitting with right here, right now. And now we're going to hear from Ram Rahat, who is originally from Canada and has been in Israel for 20 years and is also with Yesh Gavul. And you were telling me, Ram, that you've been involved in the peace movement in Israel for a while. So to make sure that we don't run out of time, if you could tell your own story real quick and give kind of an overview, because my understanding is there's almost 500 people who have refused. Well, tell me about that, refusing to serve in the occupied territories. So tell me your story real quick and then an overview of what's going on politically.
Okay. Well, fortunately, my story is much less colorful than Ishai's is, so it can be told very quickly. I was drafted into the Israeli Army in January of 1982. I came as a new immigrant to Israel 2 years before then, and became a citizen and went to the army like anyone else has to do. And they accepted this as something important to do for the country, to defend the country. Mm-hmm. 6 months into my army service, Israel invaded Lebanon. And this was despite the fact that there had been no attacks by the Palestinians in southern Lebanon and Israel for the year that preceded it. And there, in fact, had been a ceasefire that the PLO had honored meticulously. But Sharon apparently had other plans and decided to invade Lebanon in order to destabilize the Palestinian presence there.
And that was quite a big massacre, I understand.
Well, the massacre came later. I'm talking about the original invasion. I had always been grown up as a leftist activist. I came to Israel as a member of a socialist Zionist youth movement. I believe that Israel is my home. I still believe is my home as a Jew, but I always had left-wing, solid, very left-wing values. And when I saw this, I knew that this had nothing to do with the defense of Israel, and I wanted no part of it. When I was ordered to go into Lebanon in July 1983 as part of a medical unit, I am attached to the medical corps in the Israeli army, I told my commanding officer that I can't do this, that I'm not willing to take part in an invasion that has nothing to do with the security of Israel. Unlike Ishai, I got lucky. I wasn't sent to prison. And this is true of many refuseniks, people that refuse to serve in the territories or even in Lebanon at that time, do not get sent to prison. They just get moved aside to another job in the army. I was sent to a base outside of Tel Aviv, and that's where I've been doing my reserve duty ever since. I've been doing reserve duty obediently for the past 20 years. Like Ishai, I believe the army has a real role to play in Israeli society, defending Israeli society, not being used for political aims, not being used to carry out an occupation. When I refused, the idea of refusal in the Israeli army was a very strange idea. It really hadn't happened very much before. Only with the war in Lebanon, Israeli soldiers, Israeli reservists started asking themselves, why are we doing this? Why are we doing something that has nothing to do with the country's real security? And for the first time, there was a phenomenon of people that refused. In the beginning, we were very few. By the end, by 1985, 3 years into Lebanon, there were 3,500 people who were refusing to take part in the operations in Lebanon. And at that point, the army started getting scared and did a major withdrawal in Lebanon, and all of the reservists essentially were pulled out of Lebanon.
I'm curious if when you were refusing, and even now, if this word about this gets in to the Israeli population, or if it's kind of covered up. I'm just thinking about the United States, which I know more about, of course, and how people get court-martialed usually for a very long time, and nobody knows they're even doing it. So is that the case in Israel?
No, it's not the case in Israel. There are times when the press and the military try to make it more low-key, but it's certainly not the case that it's ignored. In a lot of cases, it gets press coverage. When someone goes into jail, Israel knows about it. One of the things that Yesh Gvul always did was to say, so-and-so has gone into jail. This happened with Ishai as well, that we made sure that the newspapers knew that Ishai was in prison. Also, people that do go to jail don't go to jail as a court-martial. They're tried on a disciplinary action. This means that the maximum sentence they can get is 35 days. Usually it's something around 28 days. Mm-hmm. And this is because a court-martial means a real trial with lawyers. And this would mean for the army having the whole occupation put on trial, instead of just saying, we're trying you for a short time in order as a disciplinary action. Mm-hmm. Okay? You mentioned the figure of about 500 people, and this is a figure that includes just the petition of one group, of a very important and a very impressive petition of the combatant soldiers who put out a petition in February. They started with 50 people that are today. About 500 people signed on that petition. Ishai was also signed on that. However, in the whole community, refusing the community, there are over 1,000 people that we know of that are refusing to take part in the occupation. And for every one person that goes into prison from that group, there's another person that goes in from the general refusal community.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's it sounds really different than in the United States. That's good. And you say that it really made a difference. 3,500 people refused to go to Lebanon, and that really had an effect. Because so many people feel... I'm mentioning this because people feel so like they don't have any power. Maybe it's different in Israel than in the United States, but the whole issue of powerlessness, or feeling like people feel that they just can't do anything, is something that's really a challenge. So where are things at now? We were just quickly running out of time here. Let's see, it's getting toward the end of May, toward the end of May in 2002. Just to say where we are. So what do you think is going to happen in Israel in terms of the attacks on the Palestinians?
Look, we're now at a very dangerous time. We're still going through what I would call the upward spiral of violence that we've seen since the beginning of the present Intifada. In other words, the situation where one side uses violence, the other side uses counter-violence, and so on and so forth. No side really considering how to put a stop to this, but every side only seeing their own pain and reacting with their own pain. And the extremism and the attacks and the violence on both sides is keeping each side going. At the moment, I don't see that we're moving towards a better situation. I would say we were moving to a situation that is still deteriorating. But there are signs. Certainly in the Israeli peace camp that is getting a little bit stronger. The refusal movement is growing. We saw a demonstration of peace now calling for withdrawal from the territories of close to 100,000 people last week, which was quite impressive. So there are signs. It's not a good situation. And I think we have to find a way to get to a dialogue between Israelis and Palestinians that each side can see each other, can really understand each other and talk to each other, because this is the problem. We have two peoples, two groups that don't really see each other, don't understand each other, don't know the needs, desires, and fears of the other side.
Okay, well, thank you very, very much for taking a stand and for this interview today. Ram Rahat and Ishai Shagi, who are two Israeli peace activists. And my name's Sue Supriano. Thanks for listening.